his father's handiwork. The brass cases had been annealed at the neck and carefully polished. Things of beauty. The case mouths had been chamfered, the primers seated to consistent depth, the powder charges weighted carefully, and the bullets seated to sit at a specified distance from the lead of the barrel's rifling. His father had presented him with the rifle and these 50 rounds of hand-loaded ammunition back in Coronado almost 15 years ago. It was the last time Reese had seen his father alive. A small piece of paper, cut perfectly to size, was taped inside the lid of the box. Printed on it were the details of the load, down to the smallest detail. The muzzle velocity was listed, as was the drop of the bullet, at specified distances. At the bottom, written in blue ballpoint pen, was a note from his father.
James, precision with a rifle requires precision in thought. Don't miss, son. Love, Dad.
Reese didn't plan on missing. He loaded a round into the magazine, pressing the cartridge downward until it clicked under the frame rails of the action. The bolt went forward and down like silk, a testament to the many hours its designer spent fitting and polishing the parts. Reese found the target in the scope and raised his head from the comb to take note of the wind. There was very little of it this morning, which certainly made his life easier. He settled back into position, holding the rifle firmly but without exerting any undue force. His right hand hold was on the grip of the stock and his left hand on the bag supporting it. He carefully shifted the rifle and bags until the rifle pointed at the center of the target without him commanding it there, assuming what is called the natural point of aim. Reese held just above center to account for the distance, slowing his breathing, and the scope's reticle aligned with the vertical and horizontal lines of the target's grid. He filled his lungs with air and carefully exhaled as his finger moved toward the trigger and began applying pressure. At the natural respiratory pause between breaths, Reese continued the trigger press until the sear was released, sending the firing pin toward the primer under spring pressure and setting off a chain of events that sent the bullets spiraling forward across the desert floor. The rifle's recoil was significant, but not painful, due to the design of the fiberglass stock. Reese recovered from the muzzle rise and put the scope back on the target to find a .30 caliber hole placed perfectly at the target's center. His current location was just above sea level, and his target would be at a much higher elevation, but knowing his zero was a necessity. He could make adjustments when he knew the precise density altitude at the target site. He pulled the bolt to the rear and the empty case flipped onto the blanket. He loaded 3 more rounds into the magazine and closed the bolt, moving the safety lever to its center position. Reese pulled a pair of Swarovski binoculars from one of the bags and found a distinctive-looking boulder several football field lengths away. Setting down the Austrian binoculars, he checked the distance using his rangefinder, 735 yards. He consulted his data card and made the appropriate elevation changes using the dial on top of his scope. The wind had picked up a touch, a half-value breeze from his right that was somewhere between 3 to 5 miles per hour. Settling back into position, he held for the wind using the scope's reticle and repeated the careful process of sending a precision shot downrange. The second shot once again sent his image of the target into a blur of recoil as the bullet left the muzzle. He was able to get the scope back on the boulder in time to see the bullet's vapor trail descend into the center of the target. Hit. He found 2 other targets at different ranges and made 2 more solid hits. Satisfied, he dialed the elevation back to zero and placed the rifle back into its case. The empty brass was returned to the vacant slots in his father's box of handloads, and both the rifle and ammunition were placed on the floorboard behind the front seat. Reese could have tested his Eccles Legend hunting rifle on most any public rifle range, but the next 2 weapons would attract far too much attention. He was sure he was breaking 6 federal laws as well as various sections of the Uniform Code of Military Justice by failing to turn in his weapons case and a few more by liberating the gear, heavy weapons, and explosives from the armory. but those charges would pale in comparison to the crimes that he was about to commit. He pulled his 10.5-inch-barreled M4 assault rifle from inside the hard-sided Pelican case and inserted a 30-round P-MAG into the magwell, essentially a shorter version of the weapon that most U.S. troops used in combat. Reese's rifle had been spray-painted in a tan and brown camouflage pattern. The railed forend of the rifle held an ATPL infrared laser that was only visible through night vision devices, but it also had a visible laser setting that Reese selected. A surefire scout light was mounted at an angle on the weapon's right side between two rails for easy access from the vertical foregrip. On the flat top of the rifle's receiver, an EOTech holographic weapon sight was mounted with a 3X magnifier sitting directly behind it. The sight worked much like the head-up display on a fighter jet, allowing the shooter to keep both eyes open and use the reticle image reflected onto the sight's windshield as an aiming point. By looking through the magnifier, the illuminated image of the reticle was still visible, but the target appeared 3 times closer, allowing for a greater effective range. In a close-quarter battle situation, the shooter could quickly flip the magnifier out of the way or remove it completely for faster target acquisition. Reese resumed his supported prone position and fired a round at the box target as carefully as he did with his 300 Win Mag. The assault rifle's trigger was nowhere near as light or as clean as the one on his Legend, but recoil was far lighter, almost non-existent, with the suppressor attached. Contrary to popular belief, the suppressor did not silence the report of the rifle or the supersonic crack of the bullet, but it did make it more difficult to determine the shooter's position and lowered the noise level just as a car's muffler does the sound of an engine. As usual, technology had outpaced the military's outdated acquisition process, resulting in U.S. servicemen and women going into combat without the best gear and weaponry available. Reese would have loved to be running a suppressor from Silencer Co., but bureaucrats who would never see combat ensured that he only had access to decades-old accessories as part of political haggling that had nothing to do with putting the best gear into the hands of America's warriors. Reese fired 2 additional rounds, which gave him a 3-round group on the 200-yard target. The tiny 2.24-inch holes on the target were too small to see with only 3X magnification, so Reese traded the rifle for his binoculars. The 3-shot group was about the size of a fist and was centered on the target. Thousands of miles of air travel had not caused his zero to shift, but you never knew unless you checked. Reese rose to a kneeling position and pressed the pressure switch to activate the visible laser, firing at and shattering a rock 50 yards from his position. Reese moved the selector switch to safe and cleared the weapon before pressing the 2 takedown pins on the port side of the rifle's receiver. He pulled the pins until they locked open and removed the 10.5-inch-barreled upper receiver from the weapon's lower. He then retrieved a 2nd upper from the Pelican case and attached it to the same lower receiver. The 2nd upper wore a longer 14.5-inch barrel with a 40-millimeter grenade launcher attached underneath. A Trijicon ACOG sight was mounted to its top, along with another ATPL laser aiming device. He removed the Knight's Armament suppressor from the shorter upper and placed it on the longer barrel before confirming that both the ACOG and the laser were zeroed correctly. He reassembled the rifle with the short barrel and suppressor and placed everything back into the case. The last weapon was one that, as an officer, he hadn't used in quite some time. The Mark 48 Mod 1 was a compact belt-fed light machine gun that basically served as an improved version of the old Vietnam-era M60. Like his far more compact assault rifle, the Mark 48 that he'd checked out of the armory was painted camouflage and fitted with both a laser aiming device and an EOTech sight. Reese set the weapon down on its bipod and lifted the feed cover. He placed a 5-round belt of 7.62 by 51 millimeter ammunition into the top of the feed tray, closed the cover, and pulled the bolt to the rear, where it locked into place. True machine guns fire from an open bolt position. Unlike the rifles, which he controlled with minimal muscle tension, he bore down hard on the Mark 48 to control the weapon. Reese found the box in the sight and pressed the trigger, which fired two rounds before he could release it. He reacquired the target and fired the remainder of the belt. The binoculars showed at least four 30-caliber holes in the target, in addition to the one he'd fired from his Legend. As far as he was concerned, that was damn good for a belt-fed machine gun. He repacked all of his gear into the back of the cruiser and concealed the weapons cases and ammo cans under the blanket before stacking his luggage on top. His business concluded, he climbed back into the driver's seat and made his way back to the interstate. Flagstaff, Arizona. As Reese headed east and then north, he steered toward Flagstaff, where he had one last important stop to make. He pulled into the Mount Eldon Assisted Living and Nursing Center and walked through the main entrance. He asked for directions to Judy Reese's room and signed himself in as Jim Watson before heading down the hallway. When he opened the door to the small but immaculately kept room, he saw his mother sitting upright in a recliner. She wore a white sweater and khaki pants, hair perfectly coiffed and her makeup a bit smeared. Despite her condition, and with the help of the understanding staff, she'd maintained her outward dignity as a Southern lady. She seemed to take no notice of him as he walked in the door and shut it behind him. He gave her a hug and a kiss on the cheek, taking a seat on the couch directly across from her. He'd been in high school when she had her first stroke, and though she recovered physically, she was never the same again. Her dad used to joke lovingly,
"She didn't play the piano before and isn't going to start playing now."
Not surprisingly, she began showing signs of dementia in her late 60s, and after his father's death, she went downhill quickly. It took every dime that his father had left behind to put her in a place that would take good care of her, and she had quickly become a staff favorite. Reese made it to Flagstaff as often as he could, though never as often as he intended, sitting with his mother and reading to her from her favorite books. In reality, much of the mother he knew was already gone. Still, he had to say goodbye to what was left. His mother rarely spoke these days, and when she did, it never made much sense. On a good day, she would ask you what time it was every 30 seconds. She seemed to listen, though, and she stared past Reese toward the window as he told her the whole story. If she were lucid, he would have spared her the pain of knowing that her beloved daughter-in-law and only granddaughter had been slain in their home, guilty only by association. Under the circumstances, he was pretty sure that she didn't understand, and he needed to get it off his chest. Growing up, he could always tell his mother anything. When he finished telling her of the tragic events that had transformed his life, her face remained unchanged. Then, without breaking her gaze from the window, she spoke softly, but clearly.
"In Judges, Gideon asks God how to choose his men for battle. The Lord told Gideon to take his men down to the river and drink. The men who flopped down on their bellies and drank like dogs were no good to him. Gideon watched as some of his men knelt down and drank with their heads, watching the horizon, spears in hand. Though they were few, they were the men he needed. You've always been one of the few, James. Keep watching the horizon."
Chills shot over Reese's body. She looked into Reese's eyes, and for a second, he knew that she was there, and that she understood.
"I love you, Mama,"
Reese said as he kissed her on the forehead and headed for the door, tears in his eyes. Chapter 39. Oak Tree Gun Club, Newhall, California. "Pull!" Horn shouted, raising his over-under shotgun and tracking the rapidly moving targets. As he fired, a pair of bright orange clay discs exploded in quick succession over the green shrubs in front of his barrel. He broke the gun open, allowing the spent shells to eject onto the shooting position's elevated wooden deck.
"Well done, Steve,"
a slightly annoyed Josh Holder commented as he moved forward to take his shooting position. This was his first time on the course, and he was visibly impressed by the first-class operation. The oak tree's owner had made more money in tech than he would be able to spend in one lifetime and didn't seem to mind that his gun club didn't make any money. For him, the real value was in knowing how uncomfortable its existence made the Los Angeles liberals. Horn was shooting a Krieghoff K-80 Crown-grade sporting model 12-gauge shotgun. He had purchased it at one of the special operations fundraisers he had attended with Tedesco and Admiral Pilsner. It had cost more than the average American's car and had come at an even steeper price because some other asshole had tried to outbid him on it. The glossy stock of Turkish walnut, the Germanic deep relief engraving, and the precision fit and finish of the world-class competition shotgun were lost on Horn. All he knew was that it was the type of gun that others would envy. The bidding package even included a trip to Germany to tour the factory and have dinner with Dieter Krieghoff himself, though Horn never made the journey. He did take the tax write-off for supporting the charity, of course. His assistant booked him two lessons a week with the best shotgun instructor in Southern California, who trained Horn until he could outshoot nearly anyone with whom he might walk a sporting clays course. Never one for a fair fight, he always made sure to shoot with partners who couldn't match his skill level. Holder was one of the few people who intimidated Horn, and he wanted this meeting in his comfort zone, not Josh's. "Pull," Josh Holder ordered, swinging his rented Remington 1100 toward the crossing pair, clipping the first target and missing the second. Sporting clays was not his game.
"You have to swing through both clays, Josh. These aren't rifles."
"Thanks for the tip, Horn,"
Holder said without the requisite enthusiasm. Agnan recorded both men's scores as they walked to the golf cart that would carry them to the next station.
"What are we going to do about Reese?"
Holder cut to the point of their outing.
"Well, Josh, your wannabe jihadi asset couldn't manage to kill him even when guided in with a drone to his exact location. That would have been perfect. It would have looked like some crazy ISIS type had been radicalized online and was trying to get laid by his 75 virgins."
72, sir,"
Saul Agnan said, speaking up from the back seat for the first time since leaving the gun club's pro shop.
"What was that, Saul?"
asked Horn without turning his head to look at his lieutenant.
"I believe it's 72 virgins."
"Whatever,"
Horn continued.
"The bottom line is that was our best shot at him without raising too many red flags. The evidence would have pointed to some crazy lone wolf terrorist who had seen Reese in the paper with the coverage of the Afghanistan debacle and then from the additional coverage of his family's funerals and decided to martyr himself for the cause. Case closed."
"First off, that was the Hartley's classified asset,"
Holder corrected.
"It still boggles my mind that you even know about it. Secondly, I just ran the agent, gave him the instructions. I didn't train him up."
"It's still your fuck-up, Josh. Don't worry, the Hartleys don't blame you, but they are done helping. We need you to handle this."
"Let me remind you that you guys were supposed to take him out overseas. I've more than pulled my weight on this."
"You're the right man for the job, Josh."
"I work for JD, not you."
"What do you want?"
"I want points on this thing."
"Fine. We can't afford to dilute this thing much further, but you can have a piece."
"I want 10%.
"Horseshit. I'll give you 2. 2% of this is enough to set up your unborn grandkids."
5% or Reese is your problem."
Horn stared ahead silently as he steered the cart.
5 it is, but you get jack shit unless you take him out."
"Fine. Any preference on how I do it?"
"Can't you just suicide him like you did his little buddy, you know? Make it look like he is so distraught by what happened in Afghanistan and to his family that he just couldn't take it and decided to eat a bullet. No one would question that. How many veterans kill themselves every day anyway?"
"Sir, estimates run from 1.5 to 22.
Agnan offered.
"That was rhetorical, Saul. Stop interrupting."
"Yes, sir." "That's easier said than done, Horn. Reese is on alert now. He knows he's being hunted. He's probably using prepaid phones, and I'd be surprised if he goes home again. Without DOD's drone assets and access to national intelligence databases, it will be tougher to find him. Not impossible, just tougher.
If he drove a newer car, we could just hack its GPS system, get his location, and send my contractors to kill him. He'd be no match for the 15 battle-hardened mercenaries we pulled back from overseas to handle this. Too bad he drives that ancient piece of shit Land Cruiser.
Horn, do not send those Neanderthals to kill him. They are tied to you and the Hartleys through your military contracts. Plus, they are the hammer. We need a scalpel.
Can you get it done or